the difference. Never mind the weather. When you come to Tommy's, the holiday's forever.
Welcome indeed. Yes, I've just put on my other hat, and this is Arnaldo of Tommy's Holiday Camp, and welcome once again to my regular show every Friday, 7 to 9pm, for madness, thrills, spills, fun and laughter. So, got a great show tonight, if I may say so myself. One of my absolute, obviously, music heroes is Jimi Hendrix. And we have the world's authority on Jimi Hendrix. Is that right, Steve?
Well, I don't know if I could say world authority. but yeah. I've been doing it quite a while. So I like to think going back to when I was 12 and first heard him on a radio station called KMPX in San Francisco, what was then called Underground Rock Radio. And they would play whole album sides.
Mm.
But from that point on, life changed for me. And started archiving his music, and in the 70s, I discovered there was a growing network of collectors out there all across the states, all across the world, and before the internet, I was able to trade with them their list and their cassette tapes, and we would go back and forth, you know, two tapes of the LA Forum show for one of your Ontario shows and things like that. So then in the late 80s, still before the internet, kids...
There was a time?
There was a time before the internet, way back when. I thought, well, let's bring everybody together. And I did it in the form of what was called a fanzine. Mm. And it's just something you do out of your house, a labor of love, pure passion. And it developed from a four-page newsletter to a 52-page bi-monthly international fanzine.
Oh, my goodness.
Available around the world. I had Japanese subscribers. It was pure fun. And did that for about almost 10 years, and then went to work for the family of Jimi Hendrix. I assisted them in getting back to the rights to the family. They were about ready to be sold overseas to overseas investors. Huh. And all Al Hendrix, God bless his soul, all he was getting a year from the millions that were made on the Jimi Hendrix catalog was $50,000 a year.
Oh, my.
Yeah, and so it was going to go to zero pretty soon. But he filed a lawsuit and was able to get back everything, you know, the image, the rights to the image, the music, and the whole catalog. And since 1996, they've been in business as Experience Hendrix in Seattle and, you know, reshaping the catalog and continue to put out a great product to this day.
Oh, wonderful. So it is a success story there.
It is a success story. Yeah. And along that way, too, I wrote a biography called Black Gold, The Lost Archives of Jimi Hendrix, which came out in 2002. I've lectured all around the country, including Canada, at various universities, and teach a class at College of Marin on Jimi Hendrix.
Which is going on right now?
Which is going on right now. I've got almost 30 students in there.
Oh,
yeah, so
fantastic.
It's a lot of fun. It's a great experience, to pardon the pun there. And one of the other two things that I'm working on Hendrix-wise this year is I'm an organizer at the West Fest, and last year I got this idea from Country Joe McDonald, who gathered together 2,052 guitar players over in Concord, and they did the they broke the record for the world's largest guitar ensemble.
Wow.
With playing This Land Is Your Land, This Land Is My Land, and I thought, well, why don't we bring it back home and do it Jimmy style and register with the Guinness Records. And hopefully this year we'll gather 3,000 guitar players on October 25th as part of the West Fest Woodstock 40th Anniversary Tribute.
Mm.
It's at Speedway Meadows. And you can go on my website, steveroby.com, and just send us your email. And if you plan to play acoustic or electric, if you plan to play electric, though, you got to bring your own battery-powered amp, which is pretty easy. You can get a 9-volt battery and clip it to your belt,
right,
and rock out, you know, electric style.
What are they going to play?
Purple Haze.
Okay.
it's never been done before. There's some guys over in Poland that have been doing it for years and have gotten close to breaking the record with Hey Joe. Mm. And so I thought, well, you know, Hey Joe was, you know, kind of Tim Rose's song. Purple Haze is a little bit more difficult to play. But in about a week, we'll have an instructional video up on my website for kind of just beginners learning how to strum along and learning the chords to it. And you'll be able to follow along with that.
Wow, so we'll be able to play just like Jimi Hendrix then.
Well, it's not a talent show. It's not America's Got Talent, you know. But it's all about having fun. I mean, if we break the record, super fun. You know, everybody goes down in the record books. But if not, you know, it's still going to be a sea of guitars out there. Paying tribute to Jimmy, who played at the original Woodstock Festival.
That's right. Yeah. He fully deserves the honor.
Yeah, and not last but not least, I'm working on a second Hendrix biography called Before London, all about Jimmy's R&B years, 1962 to 1966.
Oh, I definitely want to hear about that in the show. Yeah, definitely. Well, let's play a bit of Hendrix. We've talked about him. His top 40 hits.
His only top
must be some kind of way out of here. Say the joker to the thief. There's too much confusion. I can't get no relief. Businessman there, drink my wine. Plowman, take my earth. None will level on the mine. Nobody up it is worth. No reason to get excited.
Yeah, just a fine example of Jimi Hendrix doing a Bob Dylan song cover. Not a bad cover, Steve, don't you think?
Oh, so it's wonderful. In fact, Jimmy, that was not the only Bob Dylan song that Jimmy covered. He also did The Drifter's Escape and... just gone blank on that. Sorry. There's the expert for you. Can you please come crawl out your window? And there's a unreleased version of Tears of Rage that he does.
Huh.
And he was considering doing I Dreamed I Saw St. Augustine. So Dylan's John Wesley Harding album really influenced him greatly. As did Blonde on Blonde, too. In fact, funny story. The lady he was living with in 1966, they were getting plugged out of every hotel room apartment that they stayed in for back rent due.
Oh, no.
And so Jimmy was down to $5, and he went out and bought a copy of Blonde on Blonde and came back and showed it to his girlfriend, and she just about had a fit. You know, they needed some food. They needed to pay some rent. And but he says, come here, listen to Blonde on Blonde.
That's a true musician.
That's a true Dylan fan. Yeah.
A Dylan fan, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, perhaps we can go, where did Jimmy, who was born in Seattle, maybe you can give us a little bit of background. I mean, how on earth did this kid in Seattle become an amazing guitarist that changed music?
Well, he was always fascinated by music. He and his brother Leon... grew up together, and Leon's got a great story about how Jimmy always wondered where he was fascinated with radio, fascinated with his father's record collection. And Al Hendricks had a great blues collection, and they would play Muddy Water and Howlin' Wolf. And one day when Al was out to work, Jimmy started tinkering with the family radio. And when Al came home, Jimmy couldn't put it back together. And he says, Jimmy, what are you doing to the radio? I says, well, Dad, I just wanted to find out where the sound came from. But from there, Al realized that Jimmy wanted to play a musical instrument. He got him a harmonica, and they were tooling around with various string instruments. There was a cigar box with a rubber band on it, one-string ukulele. And it graduated from there to an acoustic guitar and then finally an electric guitar. But it really wasn't after his mother died when he was about 15 years old, that he really got serious about music. And in fact, when he was going through high school, when he couldn't have his guitar, he'd be walking down the hallways, and a lot of his fellow students would say, hey, Jimmy, what do you got in your hand? There's nothing, but you're holding on to something. What do you got? It's my imaginary guitar, man, you know.
Whoa, so he was doing air guitar.
He was doing air guitar. But from there, he kind of dropped out of school. He was having a lot of problems not showing up. The death of his mother was very devastating to him. And one of the solutions that Al Hendricks came up with for he and his brother Leon, right after their death, instead of letting them go to the funeral, Lucille's funeral, he said, well, this is how men handle problems like this. And he poured each of the boys a shot of Seagram 7 and said, this is the way we do it. So I was like,
wow.
That was kind of tough, yeah. So Jimmy kind of went inward. He really got into his art, beautiful artwork he would do, and playing and practicing on front steps, and really didn't want to go home, but, he just was obsessed with music. But he needed to do something about a career. Went to work for his father's landscaping business, but carrying hot stones and taking orders from Dad wasn't for him, and... I did a little investigation for my next book called Before London, and Jimmy got arrested twice almost in the same week for taking a an owner's car without permission, joyriding.
Okay.
And it turns out there's a little bit more to the story. There was actually a teenage crime wave going on in Seattle, and the cops were looking for a bunch of teenagers, juvenile delinquents, that were... on a crime spree. They were breaking into homes, laundromats, stealing money, and this and that. And here comes four African-American guys in a car having a great time, stood out, popped and arrested. First time it was kind of a slap on the hand. But the second time around, he had to spend 7 days in a juvenile detention center. And he was, had just passed 18, hadn't finished school, and the judge kind of laid it to him on the line. He says, well, if you want to get your life together, son, probably the best thing to do is go down and enlist in the Army. And that's what he did.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Ooh. And that, what year was that?
That was 1961 that he joined, May of 61. And he was really gung-ho at first, you know. He wanted the Screaming Eagle patch. He thought it was kind of a proud badge of honor to wear for his family. He wanted to make his father proud. Huh. And that Screaming Eagle patch was going to do it for him. And he really tried, but he wasn't the best marksman in the world. And he was missing his guitar too much. His guitar was at his girlfriend's house, Betty Jean Morgan's.
Oh, he had a long-term girlfriend?
They were engaged to get married. He was going to get her a ring, fly her out to Fort Campbell, Kentucky. But it didn't happen. But as soon as the guitar came from Seattle, life changed. Forget the Army. Forget bed checks. Hey, there's a club in town called the Pink Poodle Club, and they play some good R&B down there. And I've just met my good friend Billy Cox, who plays bass. And Jimmy's story of how he got out of the Army was that he, on the 26th jump, he was a parachutist, paratrooper, that he hurt his ankle, hurt his back. But I thought there's always something else to a Jimmy story than what he says or told the press. And after further investigation on my part, I ordered the 80 pages that are available of Hendrix's Army documents that are available to the public at about $1 a page. You have to pay for the photocopying charges. But in there, you see that they were building a case against Jimmy. Once the guitar started coming in, his fellow enlistees started noticing that he was missing bed check. He was sleeping too late. He and Billy figured out a scheme that after how they kind of did some things, you know, that they had to do at 10 o'clock in the morning, they could kind of sneak away and then kind of fade back in around 4 o'clock in the afternoon, do a little bit more, and then fade back out and go down to the club down in Clarksville. And some of the stories, the comments by the fellow officers are really damning. I mean, he was doing some things that men do in the bathroom that you shouldn't do, if you acquire my drift there. And they turned him in. And so it was basically, they said, you know, see you later, soldier. You know, this is the Cold War. The Russians are going to come. The commies are going to come. And we need bright, intelligent soldiers, not guitar players that would rather be playing down at the Pink Poodle Club. Yeah.
Not good image for the Army.
No. And Jimmy was happy to get out, yeah.
Oh, I would imagine by that time it sounds like he was ready.
Oh, yeah, more than ready, yeah. He waited till his Army buddy, Billy Cox, got out of the Army just a few months after that. And they eventually formed a group called the King Casuals. Mm. And they took on a guy from another guitar player from Indiana, which is close by. And they discovered that, you know, the action was really happening down in Nashville. In 1962. Nashville actually was putting out more records, country and western records, R&B records too. Elvis was recording down there, more in Nashville than in Memphis. And so they found a club down there, kind of in the African-American district of the clubs down there near some of the universities, a place called the Del Morocco Club. And Jimmy could cut loose, and he ended up playing with a variety of different other bands. In fact, I found a advertisement for a it's kind of funny. Billy Cox got this wild idea that he would be a promoter.
Okay.
So he had a band called Billy Cox and the Sandpiper, but the opening act was Jimi Hendrix and his magic guitar. So if you can imagine that. But there's some great photos that exist of those days of Jimmy playing behind his back and with his teeth and everything like that.
Oh, okay. Well, let's play some music, and I want to talk about that, you know, where that stuff came from.
Okay,
let's do some cross town traffic.
Speed I drive.
fell across your back. I can see you had your fun, but darling, can't you see my signals turn from green to red? And with you, I can see a traffic jam straight up ahead. You're just like.
Jimi Hendrix, Crosstown Traffic, and I have a guest in the studio, Steve Roby, our historian, lecturer, and archivist of Jimi Hendrix. And this is Arnaldo, your host at Tommy's Oldie Camp, every Friday from 7 to 9 on Cowles Radio. Phone number in the studio, if you've got any questions for Steve about Jimi Hendrix, give us a call, area code 707-874-1073. So, well, Steve, we're talking. You're just talking about how Jimmy got started in the army and just after. Now, you mentioned his magic guitar, and how on earth did he learn to play like that?
Well, he was influenced. I'm sad to say it's not an original idea that he came up with. In fact, it dates back even further into the 40s and 50s. There were guys like T-Bone Walker that were doing these wild splits and playing loud electric guitar. And there was that influence. And a lot of people that I interviewed just recently, in fact, from Nashville, were telling me that if you really didn't do these tricks and you didn't do them well in Nashville, you know, you were out the door. You know, you had to entertain. It wasn't just stand up there and strum and sing and do a little dance. You had to, you know, wow the crowd. In fact, his bass player, Billy Cox, built him a boom. He built him a boom mic. It boomed him on the head. No, he built him a a 100-foot cord from Radio Shack that he kind of customized so that Jimmy could walk out into the crowd and walk toward the door. I don't think it made it all the way out to the sidewalk because the technology back then was when the further he got away, it started to echo. Mm. You know, I mean, it probably would have sounded cool in the later 60s, but for a bunch of, you know, bar goers, you know, at 11 o'clock at night, you know, this echo feedback during a, you know, an R&B song wasn't their cup of tea. But yeah, it was a lot of fun. So from there, struggling in Nashville to make it and everything like that, a promoter came along from one of the from the Supersonic Attractions show that would do these package shows with like Sam Cooke and Jackie Wilson. And, you know, the top, they would do like, they would get like 10 or 14 acts on a bill and come through town. So he was looking for a guitar player and he said, hey, you know, I'm going up to New York. Why don't you come along? You look like you've got talent. Sure enough, Jeremy, it's just, yeah, New York, you know, the Big Apple, hey. Yeah, let's do it. Nashville, nah. So he wanted to see if his fellow friends wanted to come along, but they had suspicions about this guy. He kind of talked a little funny and nice dresser. So he and Jimmy got a hotel suite together at the Hotel Teresa in New York City. And, you know, it was all very nice and exciting, but the day after, Jimmy was a ladies' man, and Jimmy brought a lady back to the hotel suite without his accompanying friend promoter. And when he saw that he had a lady in the suite, the promoter said, both of you are out.
He was looking for something else.
If
yeah.
you know what I mean. Yes, yes. So Jimmy, funny, he had the day before he had met two local singers that were hooked up with Little Richard. And they moved. Jimmy moved in with them in the suite. And Jimmy started making friends. In fact, he made a lady friend, Lithophane Pridgen, who helped him meet Sam Cooke. Oh. And that was a very brief audition. Jimmy didn't get the gig with Sam Cooke at the Apollo. But, you know, he kept struggling around and started playing at these clubs, got his name out there, eventually hooked up with the Isley Brothers. And but just prior to that, He made a recording with singer Don Covey.
Oh, yes.
Did the song Mercy, Mercy, which I'm proud of myself of being the one that discovered that Jimmy was involved with this. His only other top 40 single than All Along the Watchtower. And the song that actually inspired the Stones to cover it, the Rolling Stones at the time. They did a cover of Mercy, Mercy.
Oh, right, of course, yeah.
So, you know, he had the talent. Somebody saw it, and they got him on a record. So that's his first recording that went top 40. And then went, did some things with the Isley Brothers, and then went back in New York, hooked up with Little Richard, and there's a whole chapter on the Little Richard tour in my next book there. But, you know, the problem Jimmy was having was he kept upstaging the performers with a spotlight, and he would dress not in their strict R&B dress code. They wanted like white mohair suits, white ties. Your shoes had to be polished at every show. No fancy jewelry. Yet he would come out with a bandana on his leg, a wild swinging medallion, and just play a little bit louder. And finally got the boot from the Isley Brothers, Little Richard. And then just wandered around New York, and then finally somebody said, it was Richie Havens said, you got to get down to the Village.
You're kidding.
He saw him at a place called the Cheetah Club in New York, and this guy was, he just was amazed. He said, well, where's this guy? How's this guy doing all this great, amazing sounds and everything like that? And he says, what are you wasting your time here? Get down to the Village, and if you're familiar with what the music scene was like in the Village in the mid-60s with all the great art, poetry, and kind of leftover beatnik stuff. And music was starting to shift in 1966. So we start to hear Wild Thing come up by the Troggs, and rock and roll is getting a little bit more edgy. Even the Beatles, things are starting, Revolver came out in 66. And so Jimmy went down there, and he auditioned at the Café Wa, a little underground, tiny basement club. They would have a barker out there at night, and get the tourist in. And so Jimmy would play at this place called the Café Wa, and just do all this stuff. And people just loved it,
Would he go up as by himself and just play or sing? Or how did he...
He formed his own first trio, Jimmy James and the Blue Flames. He borrowed, he didn't really have any players at the time, so he borrowed the house band bass player and a drummer, and they kind of, got muddled through it, and they got... So Jimmy was starting out there looking. He discovered, actually, Randy California, later of Spirit, discovered him at a store called Manny's Music in New York City. And Jimmy, the generous guy he was, he says, hey, Randy, you don't want to come down and play with us? And so the group grew to a quartet, and he replaced the bass player and the drummer and now had a rhythm guitar player. Eventually brought in this guy named Moogie Klingman, who's gone on to do a lot of great things. he says, I play organ. I says, well, you brought your organ? He says, no, well, come back tomorrow. Bring your organ. So now we've got a quartet. I mean, quintet.
Quintet. Yeah.
And so, the band kept expanding and expanding. And they were doing songs like Shotgun, Junior Walker's Shotgun, Wild Thing. In fact, the first time Jimi Hendrix heard Wild Thing on the radio by the Troggs, he was taking a shower. And his girlfriend was in the other room, and he opened the shower door, jumped out naked, and just started playing air guitar along with it. If you can imagine that.
I can.
So he was hooked on that song. It's funny, Chip Taylor, who wrote the song, I interviewed him. And I said, so what was your reaction to the first time you heard Jimmy play Wild Thing for you? He says, well... I saw a screening of Monterey before it came out, and he lit the guitar on fire, and I kind of got down in my, seat in the movie house, and, but, it became a big success after that.
We definitely want to talk about Monterey Pop.
There's some juicy stuff there. Yeah, we just had the anniversary yesterday.
Oh, my goodness.
The 42nd anniversary of Monterey Pop. Well, the day Jimmy played, I should say.
Yeah, okay, yeah, it was a three-day event. Oh, what a great... Yeah, it's funny. There's the main Monterey Pop film. I discovered there's a whole second one, which has got some great stuff. A lot of Janis stuff on. Wonderful.
It's a 3-DVD box set. Yeah, worth picking up,
Yeah, definitely. Really, just the one doesn't do justice to all the great people who were on there.
Wow, to have been there.
Yeah, yes. I know, yeah, we can't be everywhere. We try and... do our best. But, let's play some more music. Let's go a little bluesy with Jimi Hendrix Love with a bit of Red House. Is that okay?
Sure. We'll, always good to hear the blues.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In other words, we're cooking, right? That's what you're trying to say.
Yes, Red House Over Yonder. Mm-hmm. That was definitely some heavy blues he put in there.
He loved the blues. Oh, my God. He just couldn't get enough. Mm. I mean, he would go down to this record store in New York City, Colony Records, and he would just, you know, he was specific about what he was looking for and trying to capture that sound. In fact, there's a whole CD of just blues recordings on Jimmy.
Oh.
That is really amazing stuff there.
Huh.
Yeah.
Oh, that would be nice. Just, yeah, en masse to hear that. Yeah,
well, I was talking to the producer at the time, Bruce Gary, who's no longer with us, but he was telling me when they were going through the reels and reels of Jimmy's recordings, looking for a good track that they could use that hadn't been released. Jimmy would always break into a blues song. I mean, they found Born Under a Bad Sign.
Oh,
huh. in between some other things there.
Oh, wow.
About 10 minutes of him doing Albert King's Born Under Your Bad Sign, yeah.
Oh, beautiful.
Good stuff there.
Beautiful. Just throw it, a little throwaway.
A little throwaway, but oh, my God. Good stuff.
Mm. Well, that was the throw. I mean, you know, obviously you said like a lot of his musical touches were devices well known amongst musicians, but mm-hmm. I think certainly when he came to Europe, people didn't do that. You didn't use your instruments like that. You were much more polite to them.
Yeah. Well, unless you were Pete Townsend, of course.
Well, yeah. There are exceptions.
Yeah, I think that was the fascination that, I mean, you probably could attest to this better than I could. Excuse me. That there was this fascination with R&B in the kind of the early and mid 60s in London and England and
right.
like that. And they wanted the real thing, and they, you know, imported people like John Lee Hooker right. and the lot from there. And so when Jimmy came along, you know, here's an African American guitar player that can play the blues, play it wild, and almost instantaneously after he heard it, you know, they instantly fell in love with him.
Yeah, just such so much soul in it. It wasn't just mm-hmm. playing. That was the thing.
Yeah.
There was so much more in it. Yeah.
About 6 weeks after he'd been over to England, I mean, he invited himself basically up on stage with the Cream. And after the second song, Eric walked up.